You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Sometimes the nicest people make the deadliest criminals. Enjoy a collection of nonfiction accounts by international writers and experts on crooks, criminals, and serial killers who disguise themselves among society by being what you least expect, your friendly next-door neighbor. From mild-mannered co-workers to doting parents, some might be your jack-of-all-trades friend, or others might be your family member with an altruistic persona. The best new true crime stories, well-mannered crooks and criminals, takes you deeper into the unconventional criminal psyche. The ones where the most prominent feature isn't a bloodied knife, but a bright smile and warm gaze meant to lure their next victim. Meet the real killers. You've heard about John Wayne Gacy. You've heard about Jeffrey Dahmer. You've delved into the Ted Bundy fascination. It's time for you to meet the infamous Nuan Briones, who struck fear into the hearts of the rich, and Freddie Brenman, a notorious street fighter with mysterious ties to the Dillinger Gang. You'll find yourself realizing that being nice and friendly is a killer combination. Edited by acclaimed author and anthologist Mitzi Serrato, Best New True Crime Stories, Well-Mannered Crooks and Criminals reveals all new accounts of true crime stories featuring serial killers from the contemporary to the Depression era. The international list of contributors includes award-winning crime writers, true crime podcasters, journalists, and experts in the dark crimes field, such as Tom Larson, David Blumenfeld, and Anthony Ferguson. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Best New True Crime Stories, Well-Mannered Crooks and Criminals, with my special guest, editor and author, Mitzi Serrato. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Mitzi Serrato.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Well, fine. I'm good. Thanks. Thank you very much for this interview. Nice to have you back.
Thanks. Oh, I should just clarify, you left out the rogues in our title. It's Crooks, Rogues, and Criminals.
Ah, there we go. Another mistake.
Yeah, we don't want to forget them. Yeah, we don't want to forget those rogues because we have quite a few running around on the pages.
Yes. Yes, thank you very much for that. Let's start off right now with, this is the third time that I've interviewed you about this series of books, and the first being the Best New Crime Stories, Small Towns, and the Best New Crime Stories, Serial Killers, and the Best New Crime Stories, there's a new one coming up, Crimes of Passion, Obsession, and Revenge. So for this one, the Best New Crime Stories, Well-Mannered Crooks, Rogues, and Criminals, as you corrected me, let's start with the contents of this particular anthology.
Well, in keeping with the tradition, from the tradition I've already managed to achieve from the first two books, it's a very international collection, stories set all over the world, writers from all over the world, and we jump around with different time frames. So there's lots of surprises in there and definitely offering something that maybe people don't necessarily expect when they pick up a true crime book. At least I hope so. But
Certainly.
I mean, that's kind of what my goal is to really broad worldwide perspective.
Yes, and you have certainly achieved that. Well, let's talk about the contents of this. And when you do introduce these authors, as you do in the first book, Uncle Freddie and Gentleman John Dillinger, David Blumenfeld.
Yes, that's a fun story. This is actually written by David is writes in a first-person format because Uncle Freddy was a family friend. You know how, you know, when you're a kid growing up, your parents' best friend is somehow uncle or auntie. So Uncle Freddy was his uncle, and his father had actually was very close with Freddy and even knew Dillinger as well. So we learn a lot about that time frame, who Uncle Freddy was, a lot more about Dillinger. And it was a real gem getting that story in to actually have someone who had a real connection to this legendary criminal. I mean, this guy is an icon. Dillinger is sort of a criminal icon. And from there, we move to Australia with a story called Alan Bond, the Aussie Larrikin, who went from riches to rags and back again. And that's written by Anthony Ferguson, who actually contributed to the first two volumes. Alan Bond was a very well-known millionaire in Australia, probably not really known outside of Australia that much. He was just sort of this working-class hero who made it big, and obviously that struck a chord with people because, you know, it kind of gives everyone an inspiration and something to aspire to. But how he made his fortune wasn't in a very nice way. I mean, he may have had the flash and he may have had the gift of gab, but he essentially took people's money and used it and gambled it away and just made himself richer and richer, stashed his money away, became well known for competing in the famous yacht race from the United States, which is something that the Aussies weren't even interested in. So he just kind of kept going, working his way up the ladder, the social ladder, and but he was a con man. You know, that's the end of the day. That's all he was.
Right.
And then from there, we moved to China. From a historical piece from China about a woman pirate. This story is called Qing Shi, the Woman Who Dominated the South China Sea. And that's written by Morgan Barber. This is, you know, we hear about pirates and we normally assume it's the typical, you know, macho image of a pirate. You know, it's a very mostly a male-dominated field. But she turned that on its head. She essentially had to make her way up through marriage, which, you know, there wasn't a lot of choice at that time. You had to have a husband beside you. But that was the extent of any type of needing a man. She was an equal partner with her husband. She dominated the salt trade in China. She became a military force to be reckoned with. Governments had to kowtow to her. They didn't quite like that. And she developed codes of ethics for how they would operate, and also, more significantly, a moral code for how women were treated. They were not to be treated as possessions or used, you know, especially regarding bedroom activities. You know, rape was not accepted. Things had to be consensual. So she was a hardcore feminist pirate, and she got stuff done. So very interesting character.
Yes.
And then from there, we moved to the United States in the early part of the 20th century, a story by Dean Job, who you may know. This story is called They Wanted Something for Nothing, The Many Cons of the Yellow Kid. And that's a fun story. It's a quintessential con man who actually, imagine if you were like watching The Sting, the classic film The Sting with Paul Newman and Robert Redford. Yellow Kid Wheel had an incredible repertoire of cons. And, you know, he basically made a fine art out of the scam with the wire results, which, you know, where you would rig it so that people thought they were betting on a race, but the race had actually already happened. So the results were already in. So consequently, they got fleeced. He used the old, that's a classic one. He would do the thing with the be in the audience when someone was selling like a tonic, you know, the old snake oil salesman kind of routine.
Sure.
Yeah, that one. He had such brilliant cons, and he considered himself a genius of cons. So that's another one. Yeah, that's a really fun one. Then we moved to a country that didn't quite exist. Story is called A One-Way Ticket to Poyer by Janelle Comeau. This is about a con man from Scotland named Gregor McGregor, great name, and he essentially sold a country that didn't exist. He sold it to people. They were all getting on ships from, grubby, industrialized, polluted Britain and sailing away to the Central America, to this paradise. But there was no paradise. But he kept doing this con again and again, and people kept falling for it. And then we go to my story, The American Dream, which is about an American dream that didn't quite exist or basically fell flat. A gentleman from Texas who loses his job during the 80s recession when the oil industry just went flat. And it was basically either he turns to robbery or everyone's going to starve. There's a lot of things in that story that would hit home with people right now with the pandemic and people losing their livelihoods and not knowing what to do, the desperation.
Mm-hmm.
So that touches on that. And then we go to Paris in Champs-Élysées Noir, which is written by Paul Willits, a writer over in the UK who does quite a few nonfiction true crime books and journalism. This story is an ultimate octopus. It's just got so many dimensions. It deals with art, and I'm talking very, very expensive art collections.
Yes.
A woman who marries a gentleman who accumulated this art collection, and she's sort of almost a serial killer. I suppose she could qualify and a psychopath, and wants to do everything she can to protect this art and keep it herself rather than have it go to her adopted son. So that encompasses a whole lot of things. Even the French government is involved. Then from there, we go to Ecuador in The Bandolero Lojano, and that's by Tom Larson. That's the one you mentioned as we kicked off. This is a real Robin Hood story. I mean, a genuine, 100% legitimate Robin Hood story. It's a poor this guy came from a poor, impoverished background, and just about everybody was poor. Landowners were exploiting the poor, and these people were living very badly. And this particular bandolero thought, we need to change that. So he asked the landowners to cough up some money, start spreading the wealth around. And it was such a small percentage, but they didn't like that idea. So he figured, well, I'm just going to go take it then. So he basically robbed from the rich to give to the poor.
Yeah.
And from there we go to Philadelphia and Atlantic City in a story called Little Nicky, The Tragedy of the King of Atlantic City, and that's by T. Fox Dunham. This is about Little Nicky Scarfo, who was with the Philly mob, later to become sort of a king of Atlantic City. He basically was instrumental in remaking Atlantic City when it was a depressed, dead area. And, he was someone very, very interested in his image. He aspired to be almost like this Humphrey Bogart type of glamorous Hollywood appearance, very concerned with image, not just his own, but those of the other guys in the mob. He figured he had an image to maintain, so this is how his well-manneredness comes into play. So that's got a lot of interesting elements in it. Then we go to another story, which it started in Australia, but it moves around a lot. It's called The Prince of Swindlers by Paul Williams, And this is about a con man and a bigamist, a fellow who basically just kept collecting wives. God knows why, because he wasn't exactly someone who would turn heads, but he had no problem getting wife after wife after wife. He conned his way into various places, particularly in the medical field. He kept remaking himself as this doctor or this surgeon, and he just went from to Australia, to the United States, to Canada, to South Africa, to England. It's another one of those octopus stories that beggars belief that this actually happened, but it did.
Yeah.
Yes. And then we go to early 1900s United States in The Socialite's Poisonous Plate by Jackie Barrow. This is sort of a cross between Agatha Christie and The Great Gatsby, I think would be legitimate to say. It's about a cafe society lady who, very wealthy, privileged background, very well connected. This was in the Midwestern area in Missouri, and she's married to a gentleman who's a professor, he was older when she married him. He was actually her high school principal, so it was all kind of exciting, an older man. But as the years progressed, the older man became a older man, and perhaps she got bored. Ultimately, he ends up poisoned by strychnine, and we get into the how that all happened and who did it or who didn't do it. Then from there, we go from Chicago and London in The Monk, the Brain, and the Marlborough Diamond. And that's written by David Breakspeare. And this is about a couple of Chicago mobsters who just decide to fly to London and steal this diamond from a very prestigious jeweler in Knightsbridge. And on their return to the United States, there's no diamond. So where is it? What happened? And it gets into all of that. Then we go to India in The Bombay Godmother by Shashi Kadapa. This is the first time I've actually had a story from India, so it's quite an interesting one. It takes place around the time Pakistan and India became separate countries. And it's about a woman who basically has to survive. Her husband decides to leave for Pakistan. They're Muslims. He wants to go to Pakistan. She stays in India, but she has her children to support. And she has to try to do whatever she can to survive. So she starts out in something simple, like helping to distribute rice and grains. There's a lot of black marketing going on. There's a lot of payoffs going on, and people weren't getting what they needed. So she saw a way in to survive and help people eat. And it ultimately grows from there until the point is she's actually working with members of the Bombay underworld. It's quite an interesting one. And then we finish up in France again in The Count of Blainville, The Elusive Lives of Charles Marchandon by Deirdre Perrault. And this is about another historical story. And it's about a young gentleman who essentially decides that he's going to portray himself as a count. But he's really a robber. He goes around getting jobs at stately homes for very important people, and he robs them. And then he has this extra life where he's the count, which is in another place. But it ends up with a murder. So we finished the book with a nice murder.
Well, that is a nice ending, if there's murder, certainly.
Absolutely. It's true murder. We have to have murder.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk about, before we talk about, I think, again, I'll get you to pronounce it again, let me see here.
The French one?
Yes, the Champs-Élysées Noir.
Yeah. Yeah, Champs-Élysées Noir, correct. Yeah. I had to look that
there
up, too.
go.
My French gets a bit rusty.
Mine's non-existent, so there you go. Yeah, so before we talk about that, because I think that you say that's an octopus of a story, but that is, again, one of those stories that you can't believe is nonfiction. It is so movie-esque. It is so surprising and so utterly dastardly and devious in its crimes. But let's first talk about the story that's obviously you've written, The American Dream. Take us to where this existed and Lon Perry.
Yes. Well, as I said, this takes place right around in the recession in the 1980s. Just to give you a bit of background about Lon Perry, he's one of those people that followed the rules and he aspired to the American Dream. He went to college to get his degree. He got drafted to Vietnam. Instead of complaining, he went, did his duty, came back and finished his education, got his job, got married, had a family. He did everything that Americans are told is the way to go. So he worked in the oil industry as a computer programmer. And he had had one job that he'd gotten laid off from at one point, but then he got another one, no sweat, was working in this other job. But then, the 80s came in and suddenly the oil prices just collapsed. There was so much oil that it was just cheap. Everybody's producing oil. So there's huge layoffs in Houston. Everybody had gone to Houston because it was, the place to be, great jobs, beautiful homes, everything's great. Then it isn't so great. So, a lot of people suffered and Lon was another one. He lost his job. Suddenly, bills are not getting paid. He's behind on his mortgage. He can't pay his son's college tuition. And then even more scary, he owed back taxes to the IRS, which you don't want that. So he was depressed. He got very depressed. He really wanted to kill himself. He felt that was it. Just, he'd be better off leaving his family without him. They didn't need him. That was his way of thinking. And obviously he thought twice about that and just tried to figure out what's he going to do? How is he going to keep things going? And he got a brainstorm, and that was to turn to robbery. Now, the kind of robbery he did, it wasn't like he went into 7-Eleven with a gun or held anybody up. This guy was on the cusp of turning 50. So, you can imagine this is the worst time of your life to be laid off from a job during a recession. So what he did was he decided that he would look like a typical businessman, and he went to various hotels and motels in Texas and parts of Louisiana, and blend in with the clientele and just sort of friendly his way into their rooms, as just another guy on a expense account business trip. And then he robbed them. He used an antique gun, which he had claimed didn't even work, he claimed later. But he used that, as a bit of a convincing mechanism. So he committed probably just about 100, just under 100 of these robberies, and he was quite prolific at it, and he became known in the media as the Gentleman Bandit. And this is a moniker that really was deserved because he was very polite. He never made any type of threatening overtures toward people. He wanted to make sure they were not afraid. He didn't want to frighten anyone. And he would be, very considerate when he would tie them up, making sure they were comfortable. There's anecdotes in the story about how someone had asked him, would you change the channel on the TV? He did that. He was so polite that one of his victims who didn't have enough cash went down to the hotel front desk to get some more money for him.
Wow.
Which is, I know. They said he was the nicest guy they ever ran into. Lon would even phone people at home and say after the robberies just to see if they were okay. he collected their information, so he had their contact mm-hmm. info, because his intention was, when he got back on his feet, to pay these people back. So, I mean, he really wasn't out to – I mean, he needed the money. He stole the money. There's no disputing that. But he didn't plan to keep it forever. He did plan to pay it back, almost like it was a coerced loan.
Mm-hmm. But he had this conflict with what he was doing, these robberies. He was a devout Christian, you said, and attended
yeah.
church regularly. So he even tried to quit, but the IRS put a lien on his house. So he had to go back to robbery again to be able to make those payments. And so he had a plan that he only had 3 more payments, so he just wanted to do those and then stop. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of moral conflict that he felt. I mean, it was just eating away at him. I mean, it wasn't just the fact that he's robbing, but the fact that this was just so against everything he believed in, and he was a devout churchgoer and very involved with the church. So, you know, having this constant dilemma, and as you said, yes, he had planned to quit until that ultimate lien on the house came up, and then it was like, well, I guess I have to go back to that, which he did, and hoped that it would come to an end. It did come to an end, but it wasn't the ending he'd quite expected it to be. I'm not sure how much I should give away on that, but it involved more moral conflict for him.
Yeah, the moral conflict, we won't go into, I mean, because this story just begins when he has this moral dilemma that he can't contend with this, and he wants to quit, but to throw a really big a wrench into that plan, on June 28th, a man was arrested and charged with the crimes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
we'll just leave it for the reader to be able to find out what happens when this other person, Michael David Harvey, is arrested and charged with the crime.
Yeah,
and,
we'll thank
certainly,
that carrot.
Yes, absolutely. Why don't we use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. What you won't find? Sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design make taking your vitamins easy. I chose to take Ritual Essential for Men 50+ about 3 months ago when it became available for men and teens. I decided to try it because my wife Lisa had been taking Ritual Essential for Women for over a year and a half, and she was impressed with the results of taking Ritual daily. She felt it had made a significant difference in her health, and I wanted to experience Ritual for myself. Their research into bioavailable vitamin and mineral sources has sold me on Ritual. Ritual is the multivitamin reimagined. A multivitamin should contain key nutrients and forms your body can actually use to help fill gaps in the diet. No shady extras. Ritual's delayed-release capsule design delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your ritual. Now, we were talking about the American dream, and we left the ending, of course, and much of the story for people to find out for themselves, discover reading your new true crime stories. Let's talk about the story that I think, and I mentioned before, and just before we got on the air, that this story that exists in Paris, it involves some of the most famous pieces of artwork paintings by the most famous international artists in the world, but also murder, deception, rejection, and just a host of all the criminality that could possibly be on display. Let's talk about this most interesting case a little bit more.
Sure. That's Champs-Élysées Noir. You mentioned earlier that it was almost as if something that it could be made into a film, and I was actually doing a Facebook Live event with Paul Willits, the writer, and that's exactly mm-hmm. what he was saying. It's like an undiscovered film here. It could be
certainly
one of those three-hour-long ones. As you mentioned, art is a key factor in here. Art and the value of art. It begins in the early part of the 20th century with a collector, an inadvertent collector. This fellow actually worked out of a dry cleaner's, and he was collecting French colonial West African art, and he was just selling it from the window. Actually, no, it wasn't. Yeah, it was a cleaners eventually. So this was this was Paul Guillaume, and he just started to collect. And as the years progressed, he became almost a patron for artists and encouraging them in their work. And you know, we're talking about people like Picasso, Georges Braque, Henri Matisse. And so this art collection just kept going on and on and on and on, and becoming more and more valuable. So he had a brilliant eye for art. He really knew. He really knew what was coming up and who was worthy of cultivation. The problem was his eye for art may have been excellent, but he had really sketchy taste in women. And so consequently, he met this woman who was like a hat check girl. And I guess she saw him coming. So he marries her. And she remakes herself, including actually even changing her name. She was originally Juliette Lacaze, but she became Domenica. And very, very elegant Parisian woman, high society, you know, traveling in the best circles. So she was enjoying the ride. Of course, all good rides eventually come to an end, and her husband wanted to have a child. The problem was, it seems she may not have been able to give him one, so she did what, what shall we say, what anyone would do? I don't think so, but she bought a baby on the black market.
Yes.
So there was the child, and she even faked the pregnancy, you know, stuffing clothes mm-hmm. under her dresses and this sort of thing. So I guess he never figured it out, and then he died. The problem
yeah.
was she stuck with this kid. She really doesn't want this kid, and she basically just neglects the child and just doesn't want to deal with him. And, you know, he grows up, and then, of course, there's a problem because he's technically an heir to this art fortune, and that is a threat. She doesn't want this guy. She doesn't want this kid. She doesn't want him as an adult, and she certainly doesn't want a threat to this multi-million-dollar art collection. So she arranges a hit to get him bumped off. I mean, she tried everything. I mean, she actually tried everything before she got to that point, including the fact that when he was over serving in Algeria, she essentially talked to his military commander saying, put him on the front lines. You know, she figured
yeah.
he'd get rid of him that way. When mm-hmm. nothing worked, she resorted to hiring hitmen. And so the story is just it's got so many directions that it goes in, because she's Domenica's a psychopathic personality. She really is, and a sociopath as well. And she has a lot of affairs. She keeps acquiring more art to other partners, and just becomes wealthier and wealthier and greedier and greedier. It appears that she was responsible for other deaths. For instance, her second husband. I think it was her husband or her lover. I can't remember offhand. But for instance, although she didn't actually physically kill him, let's just say when this gentleman was hit by a car, she and her lover at the time took their time getting to the hospital.
Incredible.
So
yeah.
He didn't have a chance there. She had connections with the De Gaulle government. Her brother was also a rather shady individual as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a couple. They were quite a pair together, you know, two forces to be reckoned with, getting things to happen. She just collected more and more money from, you know, this art collection was worth, gosh, let me see. I'm pulling this out. Estimated maybe 112 million U.S. dollars was the estimate of her collection, and that was not including one of her husband's collections of the early 19th and 20th century paintings. So this is like maybe 4.6 billion in today's terms.
Yeah.
So that'll give you an idea of why she wanted to get rid of her adopted son.
And you talk about, too, that she was a major investor in this Zeldija Mining Corporation. And as a result, she had become
more money.
Very, very rich.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like it says the income from that mining company was about 10% of France's annual overseas earnings. This is just mind-boggling, this kind of money. So you have to wonder, how much money do you really need? I mean, couldn't this poor guy be entitled to something? I mean, what can you physically do with this much money? But she really did not want to share this with her adopted son, who was known as, under the name Polo, that was, I guess, the nickname that everyone called him. And I guess figured it was better off just to have him killed off than to share the wealth.
But that's not the only person they, like you say, that they were planning to murder or are associated with murder, including the husband that mysteriously goes for a walk across the street, gets hit by a car, and then they wait to call an ambulance and say, no, we'll take them there. And then when they go, the hospital's closed. So, but you also talk about that they're also with the brother and then her lover, this Maurice Lacour, Jean Lacaze, his very rich girlfriend, Margaret Biddle, they go out for an evening to the opera, and suddenly she is unwell, and the next day she dies of a brain hemorrhage or something, a cerebral hemorrhage. So, and that was ruled natural causes. So these people are psychopathic, certainly, and hell-bent on accumulating even more wealth. It was very interesting to see her psychopathic nature when she tells this adopted son that he's the product of a prostitute and just a lowly arrangement that he was born as just sort of punishment.
She seemed to hate him. Yeah. She basically hated him just because he existed. Even though she's the one who was instrumental in bringing him into her life, she did seem to hate him. I mean, it's just almost ridiculous things. I mean, for instance, the people that she had involved with trying to bump him off. I mean, there was one instance where he was accused of living off the income of a prostitute. He had been dating a woman who, she was a prostitute as she was trying to build her acting career. And he wasn't. I don't believe he was living off of her, but they try to, you know, paint it as if he was, you know, doing something illicit. It was just anything that they could come up with to disparage him and to just, you know, cut him down.
I don't want to give too much away, but this story is so expansive and so involved that we have to talk about that there was a contract out for this person to be killed. And so this, again, I mentioned this Lacour, that's her lover, gets a friend of his, Armand Magakesis, again, I'm butchering names, who contacted another person named Rayon. I think I got that name. Another person named Rayon. And tell us a little bit how they got this person in their mind to convince them that to do this killing. And then what does this rayon do as a result?
Well, I mean, this is what is completely insane, is that they made out as if this was to help the French state to get rid of Polo. Killing Polo would be a benefit to the French state. It was like a patriotic duty to have him killed off, which makes no sense whatsoever. But I guess the hitman bought it, except one of them actually used his head and kind of, you know, I don't want to give too much away on this, but he basically wasn't quite on board with the scheme. I guess he saw the flaws in it, or the fact that it really made no sense whatsoever. But
yeah,
I mean, it's just completely insane. And you know, they're just going all over France, you know, to the Riviera, back and forth. The story actually opens with where this chase through Paris, this auto chase through Paris, it creates this noirish atmosphere, hence the title, Champs-Élysées Noir. But it's just incredible. If you wrote this as a piece of fiction, people would probably say, I don't believe it, including the fact that the main characters, the main protagonists here, the psychopaths, had connections with the De Gaulle government, you know, Charles de Gaulle's government. Although de Gaulle was not involved personally, apparently when he found out about what was going on, he was completely mortified and horrified.
Yes, I mean, we went a little bit into the story, but it's not even half over, because then the political intrigue, but you also have a district attorney that does a secretive investigation of these Lacour, Rayon, and the other Magaras, and yet the story does not come to the ending that people might think. So this story,
no.
You are on the edge of your seat listening to this, or reading this, pardon me, and this is a really spellbinding tale. So I'm glad we at least introduced people to this remarkable tale.
Yeah, I mean, people could actually find paintings of Domenica there in Paris. I mean, just out of curiosity, if they ever want to go look, it's in the story where they're exhibited. But it beggars belief. And the complexity of this, the amount of people that were involved, it just is extraordinary. And accumulates in the late 1950s, just to clarify that. We finish off around 1959.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Going back to the first story, when we talked about the idea that some of these people use their charm and are very gentlemanly, and we heard that expression in two or three beyond well-mannered crooks, but also that they were gentlemen. And then we talked about a Robin Hood. And we talked about people that were so polite that people remarked about how polite they were. And we just talked about, you know, a robber Perry calling the people after the crimes and talking to them, making sure that they were okay, which is beyond belief almost. Let's talk about this first one, because, again, this is very interesting that the author, again, this is somewhat unusual that the author is in the story as well, as you said, with Uncle Freddy, but also that he was called a gentleman as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about this story with Freddy Brennan?
Yeah, Uncle Freddy and Gentleman John Dillinger. As I mentioned earlier, Uncle Freddy was the family friend. The author, David Blumenfeld, his dad was big pals with Uncle Freddy, and consequently did meet Dillinger. So it's the author's in there as a youngster, and his dad plays a key role as well, because he's learning all this stuff from his dad, that you're filling in the blanks, so to speak, that he didn't know himself.
Mm-hmm.
But so Uncle Freddy was Dillinger's bagman. The bagman is the guy that holds the money. So in case you're arrested, you're not going to find all your stash. you know, there's a big portion of it is hidden away safely for later when you're back out. So Uncle Freddie was also a bootlegger. So he was very conveniently supplied the speakeasies with booze. So he, you know, he's quite a well-liked figure, a cigar-chomping chap, you know, this a real character. So so we got we hear about Uncle Freddie in the story, and then of course then he and Dillinger became pals at one time, very tight. And then we go following, you know, Dillinger and his career as a bank robber. And Dillinger was a gentleman bank robber. I mean, he may have been public enemy number one, but you know, he had his code of ethics. And that code of ethics was, you know, you don't steal from the people, but you do steal from the banks. And since we're talking the Great Depression, people were not particularly enamored of banks. They looked upon the banks as the enemy, and the banks were the crooks. So in a way, Dillinger became this loved poster guy, you know, that he was taking from the banks, the real crooks. So there's some wonderful anecdotes in the story about, for instance, one anecdote where Dillinger is robbing a bank, and there's some money sitting on the teller's, you know, on the counter, and you couldn't tell if someone was giving the money to the bank or taking the money out of the bank. So Dillinger had actually asked the guy who was at the window, the customer, whose money it was, and since it was technically the customer's money, he did not touch that. He did not want to steal from the customer, but the bank, yes, that's another thing. Another anecdote is when he was robbing a bank, if there were ladies, he would be very courteous, particularly if they were attractive ladies. So there's one bit where he puts his coat down on the floor so the lady didn't have to sit on the cold floor, and she had the coat at least to shield her from that. You know, very gentlemanly. So it's just really fascinating how it gets in. It follows the whole career of Dillinger all the way up until his eventually when he's killed by probably the police, although that's open to question. And Uncle Freddie, who, you know, he basically retired after Dillinger's death. So there is a question in the author's mind that we can't ever know for sure, but the coincidence of Uncle Freddie retiring after Dillinger's death and not having to work makes one wonder if some of that money may have been ended up with Uncle Freddie, because there was apparently toward the end of Dillinger's career, he was extremely prolific. There were a slew of robberies, a lot of money was coming in, and apparently that money was never recovered. So where did it go? Did Uncle Freddie get it? We don't know.
You include to the, what I thought found hilarious was the capture in 1934 and then the subsequent escape using a fake wooden gun. And you said from that time on, you wrote, the town was Crown Point, but now was referred to as Clown Point or Wooden Gun, Indiana. So I got a good laugh out of that.
Yeah, apparently it looks like Dillinger got some shoe polish or something to he'd whittled that it sounds as if he'd actually whittled the gun and then got the shoe polish or something to make it, you know, black so it looked like a real gun. But yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of things in here. I mean, the whole thing about too the cops and a lot of shady things going on with the cops and you know, who's in whose pocket, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, that's, you know, that time period, it was just, you know, and then you had J. Edgar Hoover, the notorious J. Edgar Hoover, and he definitely wanted Dillinger's head on a platter. So he was out there as well. So it's a lot of iconic characters in this.
Babyface Nelson, certainly.
Yes. Yeah, Babyface Nelson was jealous about the public enemy number one moniker that Dillinger got. He wanted to be number one public enemy number one.
Certainly.
And he was
certainly.
Apparently quite a violent criminal, whereas Dillinger was not like a babyface.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to one of the more remarkable stories in this remarkable collection is the Qing Shi, the woman who dominated the South China Sea. There's so much to this story, and we went through quite a bit of it, but what I wanted to ask was that some of the details about them going from, her husband was a pirate, and then instead of being a pirate, he was a captain. So their rise to legitimacy, I think all the things that she did and fought for before, it was obvious that what she was doing, that she was fighting for women's rights. You talked about this ethical code that she stuck to, regardless, despite it being brutal, it was an ethical code that she stuck to and a recipe for success. But what was fascinating was her rise from this criminal element, what we would think is piracy, and certainly that's what it was, to being recognized by governments and being able to negotiate with them, and then their final rise into legitimate citizens.
Yeah, well, I mean, she became, you know, from the piracy, she really became a military leader and commanded several ships, several, you know, she had several in the fleet. So the control element there, I mean, she was the person, you know, if you wanted to get things to happen, you had to deal with Qing Shi. She also, as you mentioned, the codes were extremely important in her success, and that was how she ended up in this book, is because she was someone with a moral code. But you know, respecting, you could not disrespect rank, you could not pilfer the public fund, you don't steal from the villagers that would supply the pirates, you would not desertion, you wouldn't kill you for being a deserter. That wasn't a capital offense, but you would have your both ears removed and be paraded around.
Yeah.
So that was a bit humiliating, and that's probably was more of a deterrent than being killed, the humiliation of
Certainly.
It. And as I mentioned earlier about making sure that women were not exploited and abused, She that was something that was not going to be accepted whatsoever, and she was it was a patriarchal society, and she wanted to make sure that women were treated properly. For instance, a female captive, if there was a rape of a captive, the rapist would be beheaded. You know, she was not going to put up mm-hmm. with any nonsense.
Right.
If even consensual sex with a captive would result in execution, because I guess the mere fact that it was still a captive, a female captive, as opposed to someone who was perhaps a partner. I mean, she definitely worked her way up there. And what's interesting is, as I mentioned about the marriage issue, that you pretty much had no choice but to have a husband in order to get anywhere. Her first husband, when he died, she realized, well, I need to get another one. there was a sort of an adopted stepson of her first husband. So she basically took him next as the next husband and kept going and building up her empire, so to speak, and worked in partnership with, as opposed to subservience to.
Yes. Another story that we just mentioned and alluded to in the introduction was about this Nuan Briones, and this is the Robin Hood story.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more? Because this really, I mean, there's always, well, somebody was considered a Robin Hood. John Dillinger was considered Robin Hood, where that was basically absurd. But this guy was considered Robin Hood. He came from abject poverty, and his story is incredible, without any buts. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Well, this is I don't think this is that widely known story. The author Tom Larson actually lived in Ecuador for many, many years, so was pretty au fait with a lot of, you know, stories from there and literature from there. But Naon, I don't know, I'm probably butchering the first name. Let's just say Briones, his surname Briones, and keep it at that. He came from poverty. He ended up in his youth in a prison, which was apparently and probably still is one of the worst prisons in the world, just a horrible, brutal place. So when he got out of prison, he had to do something for survival, and his own uncle basically ripped him off. His father, Briones' father, had a small plot of land, which was an extraordinary thing for a peasant at that time. But the uncle, which would have been his father's brother, took advantage of the mother's ignorance, and he got the land signed over to him. So, I mean, he and his family were cheated out of what was rightfully theirs. So, as I said, he ended up in the prison. It was Garcia Moreno prison. And then his mother had died while he was in prison, and his sister vanished mysteriously, and apparently he never found her. So when he got out, he joined a gang, sort of a outlaw gang. And from there, that's when he decided, well, it's time to do something about these rich landowners and these incredibly impoverished people who are working with them. And so essentially he made this business proposal, which really wasn't too unreasonable, saying, you know, give a little bit of this money to everybody, et cetera. And it was such a small, paltry amount that these landowners would not have even have noticed it, almost like this donation was what was suggested. And they did not want to do that, even though they wouldn't have missed this money whatsoever. So Briones figured, well, we'll just take it then. You know, we'll just take it instead of, you know, we asked nicely and you didn't want to give it, so we'll take it. He became someone that was not, the landowners were not happy about this. No. Anybody like in law enforcement and in the military were not happy because they were in the pockets of the landowners. So the story really gets into this whole thing where they're hunting down Briones and Briones's gang, hunting him down through the mountains, et cetera. There's a lot of people, and there's, like, for instance, a military guy, a military colonel here, Colonel Maracho. He personally really wanted Briones's head because apparently he'd been injured at one point, thanks to Briones. So there was a personal element involved as well that he really wanted to hunt him down and kill him. So we're traveling through Ecuador here as Briones and his men are hiding out in caves, and it just is, I don't want to give it all away, but even though this happened many, many years ago, early part of the 1900s, he is still remembered. Briones is still remembered and held in esteem by the people because they remember that he tried to help. He tried to help the peasants. And there's actually a stone, a white stone that has his name on it by where he was killed.
Yes, and you talked about, too, in the 1950s, there was desperados claiming to be sons of Juan Briones, but they preyed on the poor people.
Tried to milk that reputation, but they did not follow the philosophy, unfortunately. It was just, rather sad.
Mm-hmm. Certainly it's a legendary figure now, this person.
Yeah, yeah.
Juan.
Yeah, it was just, this is just a fascinating story.
Yeah, certainly. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about the best new true crime stories, Well-Mannered Crooks and Criminals. Thank you so much, Mitzi Cerredo. Can you tell us about the next edition of this best new true crime stories?
Yeah, I've been quite busy, as you know. Yes, I have a fourth volume coming out, the best new true crime stories, Crimes of Passion, Obsession, and Revenge. And that's actually coming out in August. So we're right on the cusp with these two books that came out quite close to each other. But it's available for pre-order, and it's got a great collection of stories, great collection of writers in it. Some of the familiar faces from this volume are in there, and some people that I've not had in any of the books. So, yeah, so hopefully everyone will pre-order that.
Oh, absolutely. And this is a fantastic collection of stories and authors, the best new true crime stories, well-mannered crooks and criminals. For those that might want to find out, contact you or see where you are or find out more about the other parts of the books, the other series, where would they go?
Well, I have my main website, MitziSerretto.com, MitziSzerretto.com. I'm on Twitter. I have a Facebook author page, Instagram. So basically, they could pretty much plug me into the internet and find me somewhere. And my website lists all the books, has pre-order links. I have the Facebook Live videos that I also put there, so if people miss previous interviews that I've done with my contributors, they can find them. Everything's at the website, and that'll direct you to other places, should you wish to visit them.
Yes, best new true crime stories, well-mannered crooks, rogues, and criminals. Thank you so much, Mitzi Serretto. You have a great evening.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for this
interview.
You
too, Dan. Thank you.
Good night. Good night.